with desperate haste. Why did you abandon the method?
Oh, I don't know. Why does one change a flat?
Did you feel it was a failure?
I feel that about all my books. Well, goodbye, Waterbury.
I'll send you a copy of the article,
he said, as though he were uttering a threat.
Thanks. Don't be late, Sylvia. There's the Bartok programme on the 3rd at 6:30. We went together into the debris of Tottenham Court Road. I said, thank you for breaking up the party.
Oh, I knew you wanted to get away, she said.
What's your other name?
Black.
Sylvia Black, I said.
It's a good combination. Almost too good.
Was it a great friend?
Yes.
A woman?
Yes.
I'm sorry, she said, and I had the impression that she meant it. She had a lot to learn in the way of books and music and how to dress and talk, but she would never have to learn humanity. She came down with me into the crowded tube and we strap-hung side by side. Feeling her against me, I was reminded of desire. Would that always be the case now? Not desire, but only the reminder of it. She turned to make way at Googe Street for a newcomer, and I was aware of her thigh against my leg as one is aware of something that happened a long time ago. This is the first funeral I've ever been to, I said, to make conversation. Are your father and mother alive, then?
My father is. My mother died when I was away at school. I thought I'd get a few days' holiday, but my father thought it would upset me, so I made nothing out of it at all. Except I was let off prep the night the news arrived.
I wouldn't like to be cremated, she said.
You'd prefer worms?
Yes, I would. Our heads were so close together that we could talk without raising our voices, but we couldn't look at each other because of the press of people. I said it wouldn't matter to me one way or the other, and wondered immediately why I had bothered to lie.
Because it had mattered. It must have mattered, for it was I, in the end, who had persuaded Henry against burial. Chapter 3
On the afternoon before, Henry had wavered. He had telephoned, asking me to come over. It was odd how close we had become with Sarah gone. He depended on me now, much as before he had depended on Sarah. I was somebody familiar about in the house. I even pretended to wonder whether he would ask me to share the house once the funeral was over and what answer I would give him. From the point of view of forgetting Sarah, there was nothing to choose between the two houses. She had belonged to both. He was still hazy with his drugs when I arrived, or I might have had more trouble with him. A priest sat rigidly on the edge of an armchair in the study. A man with a sour, gaunt face, one of the redemptorists, probably, who served up hell on Sundays in the dark church where I had last seen Sarah. He had obviously antagonized Henry from the start, and that had helped. "This is Mr. Bendrix, the author," Henry said. "Father Crompton. Mr. Bendrix was a great friend of my wife's." I had the impression that Father Crompton knew that already. His nose ran down his face like a buttress, and I thought perhaps this is the very man who slammed the door of hope on Sarah. "Good afternoon," Father Crompton said, with such ill will that I felt the bell and the candle were not far away.
"Mr. Bendrix has helped me a great deal with all the arrangements," Henry explained. "I would have been quite ready to take them off your hands if I had known. There had been a time when I hated Henry. My hatred now seemed petty. Henry was a victim, as much as I was a victim, and the victor was this grim man in the silly collar. I said, 'You could hardly have done that. Surely you disapprove of cremation.' 'I could have arranged a Catholic burial.'
'She wasn't a Catholic.'
'She had expressed the intention of becoming one.'
'Is that enough to make her one?'
Father Crompton produced a formula. He laid it down like a banknote. We recognized the baptism of desire. It lay there between us, waiting to be picked up. Nobody made a move. Father Crompton said, There's still time to cancel your arrangements. He repeated, I will take everything off your hands. Repeated it in a tone of admonition as though he were addressing Lady Macbeth and promising her some better process of sweetening her hands than the perfumes of Arabia. Henry said suddenly, Does it really make much difference? Of course I am not a Catholic, Father, but I can't see. She would have been happier. But why?
The Church offers privileges, Mr. Miles, as well as responsibilities. There are special masses for our dead. Prayers are regularly said. We remember our dead, he added, and I thought angrily, How do you remember them? Your theories are all right. You preach the importance of the individual. Our hairs are all numbered, you say. But I can feel her hair on the back of my hand. I can remember the fine dust of hair at the base of her spine as she lay face down on my bed. We remember our dead, too, in our way. Watching Henry weaken, I lied firmly. We've absolutely no reason to believe she would have become a Catholic. Henry began, Of course, the nurse did say, but I interrupted him. She was delirious at the end. Father Crompton said, I would never have dreamed of intruding on you, Mr. Miles, without serious reason. I had a letter from Mrs. Miles, written less than a week before she died, I told him. How long is it since you saw her?
About the same time, 5 or 6 days ago.
It seems very odd to me that she didn't even mention the subject in her letter.
Perhaps, Mr. Bendricks, you hadn't her confidence.
Perhaps, Father, you jump a little too quickly to conclusions. People can be interested in your faith, ask questions about it without necessarily wishing to become Catholics. I went quickly on to Henry. It would be absurd to alter everything now. Directions have been given. Friends have been invited. Sarah was never a fanatic. She would be the last to want any inconvenience caused for the sake of a whim. After all, I drove on, fixing my eyes on Henry. It will be a perfectly Christian ceremony. Not that Sarah was even a Christian. We saw no signs of it anyway. But you could always give Father Crompton money for a mass.
It isn't necessary. I said one this morning.
He made a movement with his hands in his lap, the first break in his rigidity. It was like watching a strong wall shift and lean after a bomb had fallen.
I shall remember her every day in my mass, he said.
Henry said, with relief, as though that settled matters, Very good of you, Father, and moved a cigarette box.
It seems an odd and impertinent thing to say to you, Mr. Miles, but I don't think you realize what a good woman your wife was.
She was everything to me, Henry said. A great many people loved her, I said. Father Crompton turned his eyes on me like a headmaster who hears an interruption at the back of the class from some snotty youngster.
Perhaps not enough, he said.
Well, I said, to go back to what we were discussing, I don't think we can alter things now, Father. It would cause a great deal of talk, too. You wouldn't like talk, would you, Henry?
No, oh no. There's the insertion in the Times. We should have to put in a correction. People notice that kind of thing. It would cause comment.
After all, you aren't unknown, Henry. Then telegrams would have to be sent. A lot of people will have had wreaths delivered already to the crematorium. See what I mean, Father?
I can't say that I do.
What you ask is not reasonable.
You seem to have a very strange set of values, Mr. Bendricks.
But surely you don't believe cremation affects the resurrection of the body, Father?
Of course I don't. I've told you my reasons already. If they don't seem strong enough to Mr. Miles, there's no more to be said.
He got up from his chair, and what an ugly man he was. Sitting down, he had at least the appearance of power, but his legs were too short for his body, and he rose unexpectedly small. It was as if he had suddenly moved a long way off. Henry said, If you'd come a little sooner, Father.
Please don't think. I don't think anything wrong of you, Mr. Miles.
Of me, perhaps? Father, I asked with deliberate impertinence.
Oh, don't worry, Mr. Bendricks. Nothing you can do will affect her now.
I suppose the confessional teaches a man to recognize hate.
He held his hand out to Henry and turned his back on me. I wanted to say to him, "You're wrong about me." "It's not Sarah I hate, and you're wrong about Henry, too. He's the corrupter, not me." I wanted to defend myself. I loved her. For surely in the confessional they learned to recognize that emotion, too. Chapter 4
"Hampstead's the next stop," Sylvia said.
"You've got to get out to see your mother?"
"I could come on to Golders Green and show you the way. I don't usually see her today."
"It would be an act of charity," I said.
"I think you'll have to take a taxi if you're to be on time."
"I suppose it doesn't really matter, missing the opening lines."
She saw me to the courtyard of the station, and then she wanted to go back. It seemed strange to me that she had taken so much trouble. I've never seen any qualities in me for a woman to like, and now, less than ever. Grief and disappointment are like hate. They make men ugly with self-pity and bitterness. And how selfish they make us, too. I had nothing to give Sylvia. I would never be one of her teachers. But because I was afraid of the next half hour, the faces that would be spying on my loneliness, trying to detect from my manner what my relations with Sarah had been, who had left whom, I needed her beauty to support me. "But I can't come in these clothes," she protested when I begged her for company. I could tell how pleased she was that I wanted her with me. I knew I could have taken her from Waterbury there and then. His sands had already run out. If I chose, he would listen to Bartok alone. "We'll stand at the back," I said. "You might be just a stranger walking around."
"At least they're black," she said, referring to her trousers. In the taxi, I let my hand lie on her leg like a promise, but I had no intention of keeping my promise. The crematorium tower was smoking, and the water lay in half-frozen puddles on the gravel walks. A lot of strangers came by from a previous cremation, I suppose. They had the brisk, cheerful air of people who have left a dull party and can now go on.
"It's this way," Sylvia said.
"You know the place very well. Daddy was done here 2 years ago." As we reached the chapel, everyone was leaving. Waterbury's questions about the stream of consciousness had delayed me just too long. I had an odd, conventional stab of grief. I hadn't, after all, seen the last of Sarah. And I thought dully, so it was her smoke that was blowing over the suburban gardens. Henry came blindly out alone. He had been crying, and he didn't see me. I knew nobody else except Sir William Malloch, who wore a top hat. He gave me a look of disapproval and hurried on. There were half a dozen men with the air of civil servants. Was Dunstan there? It wasn't very important. Some wives had accompanied their husbands. They, at least, were satisfied with the ceremony. You could almost tell it from their hats. The extinction of Sarah had left every wife safer.
"I'm sorry," Sylvia said.
"It wasn't your fault."
"I thought if we could have embalmed her, they would never have been safe. Even her dead body would have provided a standard to judge them by."
Smythe came out and splashed quickly away among the puddles, speaking to nobody. I heard a woman say, "The Carters have asked us for the weekend of the 10th.
"Would you like me to go?" Sylvia asked.
"No, no," I said. "I like having you around." I went to the door of the chapel and looked in. The runway to the furnace was empty for the moment, but as the old wreaths were being carried out, new ones were being carried in. An elderly woman was kneeling incongruously in prayer, like an actor from another scene caught by the unexpected raising of a curtain. A familiar voice behind me said,
"It's a sad pleasure to see you here, sir. Where bygones are always bygones."
"You've come, Parkes," I exclaimed.
"I saw the announcement in the Times, sir, so I asked Mr. Savage's permission to take the afternoon off."
"Do you always follow your people as far as this?"
"She was a very fine lady, sir,"
he said reproachfully.
"She asked me the way once in the street, not knowing, of course, my reason for being around. and at the cocktail party she handed me a glass of sherry.
South African sherry? I asked him miserably.
I wouldn't know, sir.
But the way she did it...
Oh, there weren't many like her.
My boy, too, he's always speaking about her.
How is your boy, Parkers?
Not well, sir, not at all well. Very violent stomach aches.
You've seen a doctor?
Not yet, sir. I believe in leaving things to nature. Up to a point. I looked round at the groups of strangers who had all known Sarah. I said, "Who are these people, Parkers?"
"The young lady, I don't know, sir. She's with me."
"I beg your pardon."
"Sir William Malick is the one on the horizon, sir."
"I know him."
"The gentleman who just avoided a puddle, sir, is the head of Mr. Miles's department."
"Dunstan, that's the name, sir."
"What a lot you know, Parkers."
I had thought jealousy was quite dead. I had thought myself willing to share her with a world of men if only she could be alive again, but the sight of Dunstan woke for a few seconds the old hatred.
"Sylvia," I called, as though Sarah could hear me, "are you dining anywhere tonight?"
"I promised Peter."
"Peter?"
"Waterbury."
"Forget him."
"Are you there?" I said to Sarah.
"Are you watching me?"
"See how I can get on without you. It isn't so difficult," I said to her. My hatred could believe in her survival. It was only my love that knew she existed no more than a dead bird. A new funeral was gathering, and the woman by the rail rose in confusion at the sight of the strangers coming in. She had nearly been caught up in the wrong cremation. I suppose I could phone. Hate lay like boredom over the evening ahead. I had committed myself. Without love, I would have to go through the gestures of love. I felt the guilt before I had committed the crime of drawing the innocent into my own maze. The act of sex may be nothing, but when you reach my age, you learn that at any time it may prove to be everything. I was safe, but who could tell to what neurosis in this child I might appeal? At the end of the evening, I would make love clumsily, and my very clumsiness, even my impotence, if I proved impotent, might do the trick. Or I would make love expertly, and my experience, too, might involve her. I implored Sarah, "Get me out of this. Get me out of it for her sake, not mine." Sylvia said I could say my mother was ill. She was ready to lie. It was the end of Waterbury. Poor Waterbury. With that first lie, we should become accomplices. She stood there in her black trousers among the frozen puddles, and I thought this is where a whole long future may begin. I implored Sarah, "Get me out of it. I don't want to begin it all again and injure her. I'm incapable of love. Except of you. Except of you." And the grey old woman swerved towards me, crackling the thin ice. "Are you Mr. Bendricks?" she asked.
"Yes."
"Sarah told me,"
she began, and while she hesitated, a wild hope came to me that she had a message to deliver,
that the dead could speak. "You were her best friend. She often told me."
"I was one of them."
"I'm her mother."
I hadn't even remembered her mother was alive. In those years, there had always been so much to talk about between us that whole areas of both our lives were blank, like an early map to be filled in later. She said, "You didn't know about me, did you?" "As a matter of fact, Henry didn't like me. It made it rather awkward, so I kept away." She spoke in a calm, reasonable way, and yet the tears came out of her eyes with an effect of independence. The men and their wives had all cleared off. The strangers picked their way among the three of us going into the chapel. Only Parkes lingered, thinking, I suppose, that he might yet be of use to me in supplying further information, but he kept his distance, knowing, as he would have said, his place. "I have a great favour to ask of you," Sarah's mother said. I tried to remember her name. Cameron. Chandler. It began with a C. I came up today from Great Missenden in such a hurry. She wiped the tears out of her eyes indifferently, as if she were using a washcloth. Bertram, I thought that was the name. Bertram. Yes, Mrs. Bertram, I said. And I forgot to change the money into my black bag. Anything I can do. If you would lend me a pound, Mr. Bendricks. You see, I have to get some dinner in town before I leave. It's early closing at Great Missenden. And she wiped her eyes again as she spoke. Something about her reminded me of Sarah. A matter of factness in her grief, perhaps an ambiguity. Had she touched Henry once too often? I said, have an early dinner with me. You wouldn't want to be bothered. I loved Sarah, I said. So did I. I went back to Sylvia and explained, that's her mother, I'll have to give her dinner, I'm sorry. Can I ring you up and make another date? Of course. Are you in the book? Waterbury is, she said gloomily. Next week. I'd love it. She put her hand out and said goodbye. I could tell that she knew. It was one of those things that had missed the moment. Thank God. It didn't matter, a mild regret and curiosity as far as the tube station, a crossword to Waterbury over the Bartok. Turning back to Mrs. Bertram, I found myself speaking again to Sarah. You see, I love you. But love had not the same conviction of being heard as hate had. As we approached the crematorium gates, I noticed that Parkes had slipped away. I hadn't seen him go. He must have realized that now I had no more need of him. Mrs. Bertram and I had dinner at the Isola Bella. I didn't want to go anywhere I'd ever been with Sarah, and of course, at once I began to compare this restaurant with all the others we had visited together. Sarah and I never drank Chianti, and now the act of drinking it reminded me of that fact. I might as well have had our favourite claret. I couldn't have thought of her more. Even vacancy was crowded with her. I didn't like the service, Mrs. Bertram said. I'm sorry. It was so inhuman, like a conveyor belt. It seemed suitable. There were prayers, after all. That clergyman, was he a clergyman? I didn't see him. He talked about the great awe. I didn't understand for a long time. I thought he was saying the great orc. She began to drip again into her soup. She said, I nearly laughed, and Henry saw me. I could see that he put that against my account. You don't hit it off? He's a very mean man, she said. She wiped her eyes with her napkin, and then she rattled her spoon fiercely in the soup, stirring up the noodles. I once had to borrow £10 from him, because I'd come to London to stay and forgot my bag. It could happen to anybody. Of course it could. I always pride myself on not having a debt in the world. Her conversation was like the tube system. It moved in circles and loops. I began by the coffee to notice the recurring stations. Henry's meanness, her own financial integrity, her love for Sarah, her dissatisfaction with the funeral service, the great all, that was where certain trains went on to Henry. It was so funny, she said. I didn't want to laugh. Nobody loved Sarah more than I did. How we all always make that claim and are angered when we hear it on another's tongue. But Henry wouldn't understand that. He's a cold man. I made a great effort to switch the points. I don't see what other kind of service we could have had. Sarah was a Catholic, she said. She took her glass of port and swallowed half of it in a gulp. Nonsense, I said. Oh, Mrs. Bertram said, she didn't know it herself. Suddenly, inexplicably, I felt fear, like a man who has committed the all but perfect crime and watches the first unexpected crack in the wall of his deception. How deep does the crack go? Can it be plugged in time? I don't understand a thing you're saying. Sarah never told you I was a Catholic? Once? No. I wasn't very much of one.
You see, my husband hated the whole business. I was his third wife, and when I got cross with him the first year, I used to say we weren't properly married. He was a mean man, she added mechanically.
Your being a Catholic doesn't make Sarah one.
She took another gulp at her port. She said, I've never told another soul. I think I'm a bit tight. Do you think I'm tight, Mr. Bendricks?
Of course not. Have another port.
While we were waiting for it, she tried to switch the conversation, but I brought her relentlessly back. What did you mean, Sarah was a Catholic?
Promise you won't tell Henry?
I promise. We were abroad one time in Normandy. Sarah was just over two. My husband used to go to Deauville. So he said, but I knew he was seeing his first wife. I got so cross. Sarah and I went for a walk along the sands. Sarah kept on wanting to sit down, but I'd give her a rest, and then we'd walk a little. I said, this is a secret between you and me, Sarah. Even then she was good at secrets, if she wanted to be. I was scared, I can tell you, but it was good revenge, wasn't it?
Revenge? I don't understand you very well, Mrs. Bertram.
On my husband, of course.
It wasn't only because of his first wife. I told you, didn't I, that he wouldn't let me be a Catholic? Oh, there were such scenes if I tried to go to Mass, so I thought, Sarah's going to be a Catholic and he won't know, and I shan't tell him unless I get really angry.
And didn't you?
He went and left me a year after that.
So you were able to be a Catholic again?
Oh, well, I didn't believe much, you see. And then I married a Jew, and he was difficult too.
They tell you Jews are awfully generous. Don't you believe it? Oh, he was a mean man.
But what happened on the beach?
Of course, it didn't happen on the beach. I only meant we walked that way. I left Sarah by the door and went to find the priest. I had to tell him a few lies, white ones, of course, to explain things. I could put it all on my husband, of course. I said he'd promised before we married, and then he'd broken his promise. It helped a lot not being able to speak much French. You sound awfully truthful if you don't know the right words. Anyway, he did it, there and then. And we caught the bus back to lunch.
Did what?
Baptized her a Catholic.
Is that all? I asked with relief.
Well, it's a sacrament, or so they say.
I thought at first you meant that Sarah was a real Catholic.
Well, you see, she was one, only she didn't know it. I wish Henry had buried her properly, Mrs. Bertram said, and began again the grotesque drip of tears.
You can't blame him if even Sarah didn't know.
I always had a wish that it would take, like vaccination.
It doesn't seem to have taken much with you. I couldn't resist saying, but she wasn't offended.
Oh, she said, I've had a lot of temptations in my life. I expect things will come right in the end. Sarah was very patient with me. She was a good girl. Nobody appreciated her like I did. She took some more port and said, if only you'd known her properly. Why, if she'd been brought up in the right way, if I hadn't always married such mean men, she could have been a saint, I truly believe.
But it just didn't take, I said fiercely, and I called the waiter to bring the bill.
A wing of those grey geese that fly above our future graves had sent a draught down my back. Or else perhaps I'd caught a chill in the frozen grounds. If only it could have been a deathly chill like Sarah's.
It didn't take, I repeated to myself all the way home in the tube after depositing Mrs. Bertram at Marylebone and lending her another £3, because tomorrow's Wednesday and I have to stay in for the char. Poor Sarah. What had taken had been that string of husbands and stepfathers her mother had taught her, effectively enough, that one man was not enough for a lifetime, which she herself had seen through the pretense of her mother's marriages. When she married Henry, she married for life, as I knew with despair. But that wisdom had nothing to do with the shifty ceremony near the beach.
It wasn't you that took, I told the God I didn't believe in, that imaginary God whom Sarah thought had saved my life for what conceivable purpose, and who had ruined, even in his non-existence, the only deep happiness that I had ever experienced. Oh, no, it wasn't you that took. For that would have been magic. And I believe in magic even less than I believe in you. Magic is your cross, your resurrection of the body, your holy Catholic Church, your communion of saints. I lay on my back and watched the shadows of the common trees shift on my ceiling. It's just a coincidence, I thought, a horrible coincidence that nearly brought her back at the end to you. You can't mark a two-year-old child for life with a bit of water and a prayer. If I began to believe that, I could believe in the body and the blood. You didn't own her all those years. I owned her. You won in the end. You don't need to remind me of that. But she wasn't deceiving me with you when she lay here with me on this bed with this pillow under her back. When she slept, I was with her, not you. It was I who penetrated her, not you. All the light went out. Darkness was over the bed, and I dreamed I was at a fair with a gun in my hand. I was shooting at bottles that looked as though they were made of glass, but my bullets bounded off them as though they were coated with steel. I fired and fired, and not a bottle could I crack. And at 5 in the morning I woke with exactly the same thought in my head. For those years, you were mine, not his. Chapter 5. It had been a macabre joke of mine when I thought that Henry might ask me to share his house. I had not really expected the offer, and when it came, I was taken by surprise. Even his visit a week after the funeral was a surprise. He had never been to my house before. I doubt whether he had ever come much nearer to the south side than the night I met him on the common in the rain. I heard my bell ring and looked out of the window because I didn't want to see visitors. I had an idea it might be Waterbury with Sylvia. The lamp by the plane tree on the pavement picked out Henry's black hat. I went downstairs and opened the door. "I was just passing by," Henry lied. "Come in." He stood and dithered awkwardly while I got my drinks out of a cupboard. He said, "You seem interested in General Gordon." "They want me to do a life." "Are you going to do it?" "I suppose so. I don't feel much like work these days." "It's the same with me," Henry said. "Is the Royal Commission still sitting?"
"Yes."
"Gives you something to think about?"
"Does it?"
"Yes, I suppose it does. Until we stop for lunch." "It's important work. Anyway, here's your sherry."
"It won't make any difference to a single soul."
What a long way Henry had travelled since the complacent photograph in the Tatler that had so angered me. I had a picture of Sarah enlarged from a snapshot face down on my desk. He turned it over. "I remember taking that," he said. Sarah had told me the photograph had been taken by a woman friend. I suppose she had lied to save my feelings. In the picture, she looked younger and happier, but not more lovely than in the years I had known her. I wished I had been able to make her look that way. But it is the destiny of a lover to watch unhappiness hardening like a cast around his mistress. Henry said, "I was making a fool of myself to make her smile." "Is General Gordon an interesting character?"
"In some ways."
Henry said, "The house feels very queer these days. I try to keep out of it as much as possible. I suppose you aren't free for dinner at the club."
I got a lot of work I have to finish."
He looked round my room. He said, "You haven't much space for your books here."
"No, I have to keep some of them under the bed."
He picked up a magazine that Waterbury had sent me before the interview to show an example of his work and said, "There's room at my house. You could have practically a flat to yourself." I was too astonished to answer. He went rapidly on, turning over the leaves of the magazine as though he were really uninterested in his own suggestion. "Think it over. You mustn't decide now."
"It's very good of you, Henry."
"You'd be doing me a favour, Bendrix." I thought,
Why not? Writers are regarded as unconventional. Am I more conventional than a senior civil servant?
I dreamed last night, Henry said, about all of us.
Yes?
I don't remember much.
We were drinking together. We were happy.
When I woke up, I thought she wasn't dead.
I don't dream of her now.
I wish we'd let that priest have his way.
It would have been absurd, Henry. She was no more a Catholic than you or me.
Do you believe in survival, Bendricks?
If you mean personal survival, no.
One can't disprove it, Bendricks.
It's almost impossible to disprove anything. I write a story. How can you prove that the events in it never happened, that the characters aren't real?
Listen, I met a man on the common today with three legs.
How terrible, Henry said, seriously.
An abortion? And they were covered with fish scales.
Oh, you're joking.
But prove I am, Henry. You can't disprove my story any more than I can disprove God, but I just know he's a lie, just as you know my story's a lie.
Of course there are arguments.
Oh, I could invent a philosophic argument for my story, I dare say, based on Aristotle.
Henry abruptly changed the subject back. It would save you a bit if you came and stayed with me.
Sarah always said your books weren't as successful as they should be.
Oh, the shadow of success is falling upon them. I thought of Waterbury's article. I said, a moment comes when you can hear the popular reviewers dipping their pens for the plaudits even before the next book's written. It's all a question of time. I talked because I hadn't made up my mind. Henry said, there's no ill feeling left, is there, Bendricks? I got angry with you at your club about that man, but what does it matter now?
I was wrong. He was only some crazy, tub-thumping rationalist who interested her with his theories. Forget it, Henry.
She was good, Bendricks. People talked, but she was good. It wasn't her fault. I couldn't, well, love her properly. You know, I'm awfully prudent, cautious. I'm not the sort that makes a lover. She wanted somebody like you.
She left me.
She moved on, Henry.
Do you know I read one of your books once?
Sarah made me. You described a house after a woman in it had died.
The Ambitious Host.
That was the name. It seemed all right at the time. I thought it very plausible, but you got it all wrong, Bendricks. You described how the husband found the house terribly empty. He moved about the rooms, shifting chairs, trying to give an effect of movement, of another being there. Sometimes he'd pour himself drinks in two glasses.
I forget it. Sounds a bit literary.
It's off the mark, Bendricks. The trouble is, the house doesn't seem empty. You see, often in the old days I'd come home from the office and she would be out somewhere, perhaps with you. I'd call, she wouldn't answer. Then the house was empty. I almost expected to find the furniture gone. You know, I did love her in my way, Bendricks. Every time she wasn't there when I came home, those last months, I dreaded to see a letter waiting for me. Dear Henry, you know the kind of thing they write in novels?
Yes.
But now the house never seems empty like that. I don't know how to express it. Because she's always away, she's never away. You see, she's never anywhere else. She's not having lunch with anybody, she's not at a cinema with you, there's nowhere for her to be but at home.
But where's her home?
I said.
Oh, you've got to forgive me, Bendricks, I'm nervy and tired, I don't sleep well.
You know, the next best thing to talking to her is talking about her, and there's only you.
She had a lot of friends. Sir William Malloch, Dunstan.
I can't talk about her to them any more than to that man, Parkes.
Parkes, I exclaimed, had he lodged himself in our lives forever?
He told me he'd been at a cocktail party we gave, the strange people Sarah picked up. He said you knew him too.
What on earth did he want with you?
He said she'd been kind to his little boy, God knows when. The boy's sick. He seemed to want something of hers for a memento. I gave him one or two of her old children's books. There were a lot of them in her room, all scrawled over in pencil. It was a good way of getting rid of them. One can't just send them to foils, can one? I don't see any harm in it, do you?
No, that was the man I put to watch her from Savage's detective agency.
Good God, if I'd known. But he seemed really fond of her.
Parker's is human, I said. He's easily touched. I looked round at my room. There wouldn't be any more of Sarah where Henry came from, less perhaps, for she would be diluted there. I'll come and stay with you, Henry, but you must let me pay some rent.
I'm so glad, Bendrix. But the house is freehold. You can pay your share of the rates.
3 months' notice to find new digs when you marry again?
He took me quite seriously. I shall never want to do that. I'm not the marrying kind. It was a great injury I did to Sarah when I married her. I know that now.
Chapter 6. So I moved to the north side of the common. I wasted a week's rent because Henry wanted me to come at once, and I paid £5 for a van to take my books and clothes across. I had the guest room, and Henry fitted up a lumber room as a study, and there was a bath on the floor above. Henry had moved into his dressing room, and the room they had shared with the cold twin beds was left for guests who never came. After a few days, I began to see what Henry meant by the house never being empty. I worked at the British Museum until it closed, and then I would go back and wait for Henry, and usually we went out and drank a little at the Pontefract Arms. Once, when Henry was away for a few days at a conference in Bournemouth, I picked up a girl and brought her back. It wasn't any good. I knew it at once. I was impotent, and to save her feelings, I told her that I had promised a woman I love never to do this with anyone else. She was very sweet and understanding about it. Prostitutes have a great respect for sentiment. This time there had been no revenge in my mind, and I felt only sadness at abandoning forever something I had enjoyed so much. I dreamed of Sarah afterwards, and we were lovers again in my old room on the south side, but again nothing happened, only this time there was no sadness in the fact. We were happy, and without regret. It was a few days afterwards that I pulled open a cupboard in my bedroom and found a pile of old children's books. Henry must have looted this cupboard for Parkus's boy. There were several of Andrew Lang's fairy books in their coloured covers, many Beatrix Potter's, The Children of the New Forest, The Gollywog at the North Pole, and also one or two older books, Captain Scott's Last Expedition and the poems of Thomas Hood, the last bound in school leather with a label saying that it had been awarded to Sarah Bertram for proficiency in algebra. Algebra. How one changes. I couldn't work that evening. I lay on the floor with the books and tried to trace at least a few features in the blank spaces of Sarah's life. There are times when a lover longs to be also a father and a brother. He is jealous of the years he hasn't shared. The Gollywog at the North Pole was probably the earliest of Sarah's books, because it had been scrawled all over this way and that way, meaninglessly, destructively, with coloured chalks. In one of the Beatrix Potters, her name had been spelt in pencil, one big capital letter arranged wrongly, so that what appeared was S-A backwards R-A-H. In The Children of the New Forest, she said, written very tidily and minutely, Sarah Bertram, her book. Please ask permission to borrow. And if you steal, it will be to your sorrow. They were the marks of every child who has ever lived, traces as anonymous as the claw marks of birds that one sees in winter. When I closed the book, they were covered at once by the drift of time. I doubt whether she had ever read Hood's poems. The pages were as clean as when the book was handed to her by the headmistress or the distinguished visitor. Indeed, as I was about to put it back in the cupboard, a leaf of print dropped on the floor. The programme, probably, of that very prize-giving. In a handwriting I could recognise, but even our handwriting begins young and takes on the tired arabesques of time, was a phrase, "What utter piffle!" I could imagine Sarah writing it down and showing it to her neighbour as the headmistress resumed her seat, applauded respectfully by parents. I don't know why another line of hers came into my head when I saw that schoolgirl phrase with all its impatience, its incomprehension, and its assurance. I'm a phony
and a fake. Here, under my hand, was innocence. It seemed such a pity that she had lived another 20 years only to feel that about herself. A phony and a fake. Was it a description I had used of her in a moment of anger? She always harbored my criticism. It was only praise that slid from her like the snow. I turned the leaf over and read the program of 23rd of July, 1926. The water music of Handel, played by Miss Duncan, RCM. A recitation of I Wandered Lonely as a Cloud by Beatrice Collins. Tudor Airs by the School Glee Society. Violin recital of Chopin's Waltz in A-flat by Mary Pippitt. The long summer afternoon of 20 years ago stretched out its shadows towards me. And I hated life that so alters us for the worse. I thought, that summer I had just begun my first novel. There was so much excitement, ambition, hope when I sat down to work. I wasn't bitter, I was happy. I put the leaf back in the unread book and thrust the volume to the back of the cupboard under the Gollywog and the Beatrix Potters. We were both happy with only 10 years and a few counties between us, who were later to come together for no apparent purpose but to give each other so much pain. I took up Scott's Last Expedition. That had been one of my own favourite books. It seemed curiously dated now, this heroism with only the ice for enemies, self-sacrifice that involved no deaths beyond one's own. 2 wars stood between us and them. I looked at the photographs, the beards and goggles, the little cairns of snow, the Union Jack, the ponies with their long manes like outdated hairdressings among the striped rocks. Even the deaths were period, and period too was the schoolgirl who marked the pages with lines, exclamation marks, who wrote neatly in the margin of Scott's last letter home. And what comes next? Is it God? Robert Browning. Even then, I thought, he came into her mind. He was as underhand as a lover taking advantage of a passing mood, like a hero seducing us with his improbabilities and his legends. I put the last book back and turned the key in the lock. Chapter 7. Where have you been, Henry? I asked. He was usually the first at breakfast, and sometimes he had left the house before I came down, but this morning his plate had not been touched, and I heard the front door close softly before he appeared. "Oh, just down the road," he said vaguely. "Been out all night?" I asked. "No, of course not." To clear himself of that charge, he told me the truth. "Father Crompton said Mass today for Sarah." "Is he still at it?" "Once a month. I thought it would be polite to look in." "I don't suppose he'd know you were there." "I saw him afterwards to thank him. As a matter of fact, I asked him to dinner." "Then I shall go out." "I wish you wouldn't, Bendrix. After all, in his way, he was a friend of Sarah's." "You aren't turning a believer, too, are you, Henry?" "Of course I'm not. But they've as much right to their views as we have." So he came to dinner. Ugly, haggard, graceless, with the Torquemada nose, he was the man who had kept Sarah from me. He had supported her in the absurd vow which ought to have been forgotten in a week. It was to his church that she had walked in the rain, seeking a refuge and catching her death instead. It was hard for me to show even bare politeness, and Henry had to shoulder the burden of the dinner. Father Crompton was not used to dining out. One had the impression that this was a duty on which he found it hard to keep his mind. He had very limited small talk, and his answers fell like trees across the road. "You have a good deal of poverty around here, I suppose," Henry said, rather tired over the cheese. He had tried so many things, the influence of books, the cinema, a recent visit to France, the possibility of a third war. "That's not a problem," Father Crompton replied. Henry worked hard. "Immorality," he asked with the slightly false note we can't avoid with such a word.
"That's never a problem," Father Crompton said.
"I thought perhaps the common one notices at night. Oh, you'll get it happening with any open space, and it's winter now, anyway."
And that closed that.
"Some more cheese, Father?"
"No, thank you."
"I suppose in a district like this you have a good deal of trouble raising money. For charity, I mean.
People give what they can.
Some brandy with your coffee?"
"No, thank you."
"You don't mind if we..."
"Of course I don't. I can't get to sleep on it, that's all, and I have to get up at 6.
"Whatever for?"
"And prayer. You get used to it."
"I'm afraid I've never been able to pray much," Henry said. "Since I was a boy, I used to pray to get into the second 15.
"And did you?"
"I got into the third."
"I'm afraid that kind of prayer isn't much good, is it, Father?"
"Any sort's better than none. It's a recognition of God's power, anyway, and that's a kind of praise, I suppose. I hadn't heard him talk so much since dinner had started."
"I should have thought," I said, "it was more like touching wood or avoiding the lines on the pavement.
At that age, anyway."
"Oh, well," he said, "I'm not against a bit of superstition. It gives people the idea that this world's not everything." He scowled at me down his nose. "It could be the beginning of wisdom."
"Your church certainly goes in for superstition in a big way, St. Januarius, bleeding statues, visions of the Virgin, that sort of thing."
"We try to sort them out, and isn't it more sensible to believe that anything may happen?" And the bell rang. Henry said,
"I told the maid she could go to bed. Would you excuse me, Father?"
"I'll go," I said. I was glad to get away from that oppressive presence. He had the answers too pat. The amateur could never hope to catch him out. He was like a conjurer who bores one by his very skill. I opened the front door and saw a stout woman in black holding a parcel. For a moment I thought it was our charwoman until she said,
"Are you Mr. Bendrix, sir?"
"Yes."
"I was to give you this."
And she thrust the parcel quickly into my hand as though it contained something explosive.
"Who's it from?" "Mr. Parkes, sir."
I turned it over in perplexity. It even occurred to me that he might have mislaid some evidence, which now, too late, he was handing over to me. I wanted to forget Mr. Parkes.
"If you'd give me a receipt, sir, I was to put the parcel into your own hands."
"I haven't a pencil or paper. I really can't be bothered."
"You know how Mr. Parkes is about records, sir. I've got a pencil in my bag."
I wrote the receipt out for her on the back of a used envelope. She stowed it carefully away and then scuttled to the gate as though she wanted to get as far as possible as quickly as she could. I stood in the hall, weighing the object in my hand. Henry called out to me from the dining room.
"What is it, Bendrix?"
"A parcel from Parkes," I said. The phrase sounded like a tongue-twister.
"I suppose he's returning the book."
"At this hour. And it's addressed to me."
"Well, what is it, then?"
I didn't want to open the parcel. Weren't we both of us engaged in the painful process of forgetting? I felt as though I had been punished enough for my visit to Mr. Savage's agency. I heard Father Crompton's voice saying, "I ought to be off now, Mr. Miles."
"It's early yet."
I thought, if I stay out of the room, I shan't have to add my politeness to Henry, as he may go sooner. I opened the parcel. Henry was right. It was one of the Andrew Lang fairy books, but a piece of folded notepaper stuck out between the leaves. It was a letter from Parkes. "Dear Mr. Bendrix," I read, and thinking it was a note of thanks, my eyes impatiently took in the last sentences. "So, under the circumstances, I would rather not have the book in the house, and hoping that you will explain to Mr. Miles that there is no ingratitude on the part of yours truly, Alfred Parkes." I sat down in the hall. I heard Henry say, "I don't think I've got a closed mind, Father Crompton," and I began to read Parkes's letter from the beginning. "Dear Mr. Bendrix, I am writing to you and not Mr. Miles, being assured of your sympathy due to our close, even though sad, association, and you being a literary gentleman,
of imagination and accustomed to strange events. You know my boy has been bad lately, with awful pains in the stomach, and not being due to ice cream, I have been afraid of appendicitis. The doctor said, operate, it can't do any harm, but I have a great fear of the knife for my poor boy, his mother having died under it, due to negligence, I'm sure. And what would I do if I lost my boy the same way? I would be quite alone. Forgive all the details, Mr. Bendrix, but in my profession we are trained to put things in order and explain first things first, so that the judge can't complain he hasn't been given the facts plainly. So I said to the doctor on Monday, let's wait until we are quite certain. Only I think sometimes it was the cold that did it, and he waiting and watching outside Mrs. Miles's house, and you will forgive me if I say she was a lady of great kindness who deserved to be left alone. You can't pick and choose in my job. But ever since that first day in Maiden Lane, I wished it was any other lady I had the watching of. Anyway, my boy was upset terribly when he heard how the poor lady had died. She only spoke to him once, but somehow he got the idea, I think, that his mother had been like her. Only she wasn't. Though a good, true woman in her way, too, whom I miss every day of my life. Well, when his temperature was 103, which is high for a boy like him, he began to talk to Mrs. Miles just the same as he had done in the street, but he told her he was watching her, which of course he wouldn't do, having professional pride even at his age. Then he began to cry when she went away, and then he slept. But when he woke up, his temperature being still 102, he asked for the present she had promised him in the dream. So that was why I bothered Mr. Miles and deceived him, of which I'm ashamed. There not being a professional reason, only my poor boy. When I got the book and gave it him, he became calmer. But I was worried because the doctor said he would not take any more risks and he must go to hospital on Wednesday, and if there had been an empty bed, he would have sent him that night. So you see, I couldn't sleep for worrying because of my poor wife and my poor boy and being afraid of the knife. I don't mind telling you, Mr. Bendrix, that I prayed very hard. I prayed to God, and then I prayed to my wife to do what she could, because if there's anyone in heaven, she's in heaven now. And I asked Mrs. Miles, if she was there, to do what she could, too. Now, if a grown man can do that, Mr. Bendrix, you can understand my poor boy imagining things. When I woke up this morning, his temperature was 99. And he hadn't any pain. And when the doctor came, there wasn't any tenderness left. So he says we can wait a while, and he's been all right all day. Only he told the doctor it was Mrs. Miles who came and took away the pain, touching him on the right side of the stomach, if you'll forgive the indelicacy. And she wrote in the book for him. But the doctor says he must be kept very quiet, and the book excites him. So under the circumstances, I would rather not have the book in the house. When I turned the letter over, there was a postscript. There is something written in the book. But anyone can see that was many years ago when Mrs. Miles was a little girl. Only I can't explain that to my poor boy for fear the pain might return. Respectfully, A.P. I turned to the flyleaf, and there was the unformed scribble, with indelible pencil, just as I had seen it before in the other books in which the child, Sarah Bertram, had composed her mottos. When I was ill, my mother gave me this book by Lang. If any well person steals it, he will get a great bang. But if you are sick in bed, you can have it to read instead. I carried it back with me into the dining room. What was it? Henry asked. The book, I said. Did you read what Sarah had written in it before you gave it to Parkes? No, why? A coincidence, that's all. But it seems you don't need to belong to Father Crompton's persuasion to be superstitious. I gave Henry the letter. He read it and handed it to Father Crompton. I don't like it, Henry said. Sarah's dead. I hate to see her being bandied about.
I know what you mean. I feel it too.
It's like hearing her discussed by strangers.
They aren't saying anything ill of her, Father Crompton said.
He laid the letter down.
I must go now.
But he made no move, looking at the letter on the table. He asked,